I'm Spencer.
And I'm Andrew, and you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today we'll be speaking with Ben Adida. He's a software engineer and architect who's the executive director of Voting Works, a nonpartisan nonprofit building a secure, affordable, and simple voting system.
Ben is also on the board of Creative Commons and the creator of the Helios voting system. Previously, he has held positions at Clever, Square, and Mozilla, and he received his PhD in computer science from the Cryptography and Information Security Group at MIT.
Ben is passionate about using technology to empower individuals and organizations. At a time when it feels like we've lost control over our digital lives and have lots of questions about technology's role in the democratic process, Ben is the perfect person to talk to. Let's get him on the line. Hi, Ben. Welcome to At a Distance. It's great to be with you today.
It's great to meet you.
So it's October 22nd today, 13 days until the election. What's at the top of your mind right now?
Well, at the top of my mind is election officials around the country working just overtime is an understatement. They have dealt with the most challenging year in more than recent history in terms of elections. You know, the election world generally, when it comes to processes and equipment and everything else, moves pretty slowly and for good reason, right? You don't want to mess with the democratic process. And this year with COVID, they've been forced to change their processes across the country in very significant ways and in a very short amount of time. So top of mind for me is just all the work that all those election officials have been doing for the last 6 months that's culminating now. You know, they're working 7 day weeks, very long days, just to make sure people's votes count.
Right. Well, yesterday the FBI revealed this breach in our registration system. A lot of people got an email saying, you know, vote for Trump or else. We're in possession of all your information. Your register is Democrat, and we know this because we've gained access in the entire voting infrastructure, whatever that is. And you're going to vote for Trump or else, basically.
Right.
What did you think of all of this?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is to actually not call it a breach, because the data that those folks had access to is voter registration data that can be obtained by the public. It's actually a security measure for in elections that the list of who gets to vote is available to the public and to the press to check, right? That list is actually the right list. And so I think the FBI and the Director of National Intelligence were saying that it was an attack coming from Iran. And I think it's a disinformation attack. It's not a breach. The data, everybody has access to it. Making use of it like this for intimidation, that is definitely an attack on our democracy, but it's not a data breach. It's just an attack that's meant to scare people.
Mm. Do you think it did a good job of scaring people?
You know, I don't know. I was not the recipient of one of those emails.
Right.
I wonder how I would react if I were the recipient. I'm sure some people get scared. I mean, that's a scary email to receive. My gut tells me that we're a little bit more resilient in 2020 than we were in 2016 to these kinds of shenanigans, because we've been talking about these shenanigans for 4 years now.
Mm-hmm.
But that's my gut. You know, this is developing right. So quickly. I only have that right now, my gut.
Right. So we want to get into a bit about what you work on specifically with voting, but I guess the first question we have is, you know, how are we able, and it might seem like a kind of a dumb question, but but how are we able to securely move money on the internet, but we can't make a vote?
It's not a dumb question at all. It's a question that goes to the heart of what's difficult about voting. And so it's a completely reasonable question to ask. You know, if we can bank online, why can't we vote online? If I can talk to my doctor via some web portal, why can't I vote online? I would be remiss if I didn't use the quote from my former PhD advisor, the renowned Ron Rivest, who said, the first thing you have to understand about that question is that the equivalent of that question is, if we can land on the moon, why can't we land on the sun? And it's not meant to be an insult. It's meant to be like, conveying the gap between those two things is it's very, very large gap. And intuitively, you can understand why landing on the moon doesn't mean you can land on the sun, right? There's a lot, there's a pretty big gap there. And the reason that gap exists in the case of voting online is because of something called the secret ballot. The fact that your vote should be secret from everyone else. And that's not the case when you're banking. Mm-hmm. It's not the case when you're exchanging data with your doctor, right? When you're banking, your bank knows everything about you, all of your financial information, right? When you're talking to your doctor, the whole point is for your doctor to know all of your medical information so they can help you, right? So what you're securing when you're dealing with online banking or online health is very different than what you're securing when you're securing voting. And specifically, the way to think about it is, let's say that your banking application's been hacked. Let's say that the server at the bank's been hacked, right? And somebody takes money out of your account. It's gonna show up somewhere. It's gonna show up in your statement. It's gonna show up when you check your balance and the money's not there. Like, you're gonna find out, and there will be remediations that can be applied to fix the problem, right? If somebody breaks into your health record, you may not know, and that can happen, right? But there's no goal of preventing your doctor from accessing any of that information. In the case of voting, we want the server to not know how you voted. Like, we don't want whoever's running this online voting system to know how you voted. And you're not going to be able to check in the day later or a week later and say, hey, how did you record my vote again? Because if you could do that, you could then sell your vote to somebody who's threatening you or asking you to see how you voted, right? And still, we want a free and fair election where we know that the votes were correctly recorded. So the way that security folks talk about this is the threat model is completely different for voting than it is for all these other applications. And when you talk to folks who have spent a lot of time on securing elections, they'll tell you it's the hardest security problem we know. By a lot. So it's much harder than banking online. It's much harder than exchanging data securely with your doctor. And because of the secret ballot, because no one else should know how you voted, auditing that things went well and detecting that things might have gone badly, it's super difficult. We just don't know how to do it, right? So you can throw anything you want at it. That central question of how do you know your vote was correctly recorded if you can't or shouldn't tell anybody else how you voted? And so you can't get anybody else to help you with that, because then you'd be letting them know how you voted, right? That's the central problem. That's why we don't know how to do it. What we need in voting is we need the voter to be able to directly observe how their vote was recorded, and without the help of anybody else, confirm that that record matches what they wanted. That's why we vote on paper. Because in the isolation of a voting booth, we can have you look at that piece of paper and you don't need any help to actually check that that's the record of your vote. So that piece of paper is something you can check directly, and it is your official vote. That's why voting on paper is the only way we know how to do this.
So tell us how voting works fits into this whole.
You've been waiting 5 minutes to make that pun, right?
Yeah. Well, we're gonna get there.
So Voting Works is the only nonprofit election equipment vendor in the US. We exist because we think that election equipment, voting machines, tabulation machines, audit processes, everything that's involved in casting, counting, and verifying that votes have been counted properly, we think it can be better. We think it can be more affordable, more secure, easier to use. And that's why we exist. So that's what we do. We've been around for 2 years. And in those 2 years, I think we've done a good amount already, more than I imagined we could actually at the beginning of Voting Works. The first thing we've done is we have prototyped and deployed voting machines in the state of Mississippi. And I can tell you at length why Mississippi, et cetera, but the main reason is that Mississippi is one of the places in the country that needs an upgrade the most, because many counties in Mississippi are still using touchscreen paperless voting machines that they acquired in 2003, 2004, when the federal government subsidized a whole bunch of new equipment purchases after Florida 2000. And many of those counties have not upgraded since because they don't have the money to. So it's a great place for us to make things better pretty quickly. It's been fairly local so far. We are working with 8 counties in Mississippi. And it's been a tremendous experience to work with dedicated election officials on the ground there. The last time I was in Mississippi was actually right before the pandemic got really bad. So it was early March mm-hmm. of this year. Sadly, not been back since, but we're working with some really fantastic people on the ground there and bringing paper ballots back to counties that have not had paper ballots mm-hmm. in 20 years. So that's one of the things we're doing. But probably the thing we're doing that has the most national impact and is most relevant for 2020 is something called risk-limiting audits. And that's a kind of audit process that happens after the polls have closed to make sure that the paper ballots that have been cast by voters are counted properly. Mm. The key idea of elections in the US, you probably know if you voted in the US, that your ballot is pretty long compared to friends you might have in Europe, right? You have 20 contests, 30 contests. One county in Texas had 90 contests, I think, in either 2016 or 2018. I mean, 90 contests is kind of hard to fathom. And I live in California where we love long ballots. So these ballots are just very long. And what's interesting about that is there is no way to count these complex ballots by hand quickly enough or accurately enough, right? We think that hand counting seems like it would be better, right? Like no mistakes, no computers, et cetera. However, if you're counting complex ballots, humans make a lot of mistakes mm-hmm. and they're slow, right? So we use computerized tabulators because our ballots are complex in the US. And so we're doing great on speed. We're doing great on accuracy. But how are we doing on trust? Should we trust these tabulators to just tell us who won the election? We did all this work to get paper ballots, and then we put the paper ballots into a computer, and then the computer tells us the answer, right? We should check the computer. So there's a whole bunch of auditing processes that already exist that are out there, some ad hoc auditing processes. They're okay, but they're not statistically rigorous. What that means is that, yeah, we check some paper ballots, but we don't really have a rigorous formula that tells us that if you run this audit process, then you have a high confidence that the tabulator did the right job. A risk-limiting audit changes that. A risk-limiting audit is a rigorous statistical process for auditing the tabulation. It was invented in 2008, and there's been a number of pilots since then. Colorado is the first state that's run a statewide risk-limiting audit. They did so in 2017. And until this year, they were the only state to have run a statewide risk-limiting audit. This year, thanks to the work of a number of other organizations, and in particular, thanks to our work at Voting Works on the right software to help you run these audits and the right processes to help you run these audits, we expect to see 5 states run risk-limiting audits at the state level on the general election, which is a huge, in my mind, it's the biggest security story of the year. Like, we are better at checking tabulation of our votes this year than we have ever been in the US before. Mm. And we're proud to play a small role in that.
How do you think the setup of Voting Works, both as a nonprofit, but also the fact that it's using open source code, mm-hmm. what role, I guess, do both of those things serve in terms of the service of what you're doing?
So I'll throw one more thing in there, which is that we use off-the-shelf hardware when we build voting machines. So we are a nonprofit, we use open source code, we produce open source code, and we use off-the-shelf hardware for a lot of what we do. It comes down to trust and standing on the shoulders of giants. Those two key ideas, right? As a nonprofit, we have requirements to disclose things like compensation and all of that, which means that, you know, we can't play any games, right? Everything is above board, right? And it's a forcing function of the 501c3 that we are fully transparent. It allows us to build better trust with election officials, better trust with the public, and it allows us to do things, you know, not for profit, that things that are going to be good for democracy, even mm-hmm. if they're not good for the bottom line. Mm-hmm. So that's a really important thing. I think when you're dealing with the foundation of democracy, I think the foundation of democracy should be publicly owned, period, right? And I think the best way to shepherd that work is to be a nonprofit, to shepherd that publicly owned foundation of democracy. Open source code is also about transparency and openness and the fact that this is code that's out there in the world and anybody else can improve it. And we also get some benefit from contributions from other folks who can see issues with it and make it better. It's a huge accelerator. It's one way also to stand on the shoulders of giants, right? We get to build on top of open source code and go that much faster. And we get to build on top of off-the-shelf hardware. Mm. So think about the voting space. It's estimated to be a $300 million market, the voting machine space. That's peanuts in any kind of technical product development. Companies like Google don't get up in the morning for a $300 million market. It doesn't even factor. It doesn't even show up on their radar, right? However, we're asking of these voting machines some of the most complex security properties that we have, right? We really want the hardware to be difficult to hack. We want the software to follow all the best practices. We want it to be as reliable as the kind of stuff that NASA builds and sends in to the moon, right? And beyond. It's a little crazy to expect that we can get that level of security and reliability in a $300 million market. We think we can make it work by building on the products of multi-billion dollar companies that are already out there. Mm. Whether it's the trusted boot technology that exists in Google's Chromebooks, Apple's iPads, building on top of that means we take these billion dollar investments and we just add the voting layer on top of it. And when you're dealing with such a small market, it seems crazy not to do this. Mm. Right? So the advantages we have with our approach is we can build better trust and we can build on the shoulders of giants. That's why we do what we do.
Mm. Connected to this idea of transparency, do you think that COVID has created more of a desire for transparency and sort of this idea around shared information and something that is about like issues that affect everybody, everyone?
You know, my instinct as an individual with Voting Works and before, I'm also on the board of Creative Commons, which is an organization that promotes sharing and open sharing of data and creative works and whatnot. So my instinct has always been towards creating common public good. I haven't really thought of COVID as maybe having that effect on everybody else, but it certainly makes sense as we're facing probably the largest shared obstacle that humankind has seen in a very long time. You know, a moment where the entire world has shared context. You say the word COVID and everybody in the world knows what you're talking about today. That I don't think that's ever happened before in my lifetime where you have that situation. Yeah, I haven't thought about it the way you put it, but I think you're right. Like, yes, I do think it pushes us towards more openness and more sharing and more like we're all in it together because we are all in it together. Mm-hmm. You know, this affects us no matter where we live and what we do. One thing in the election space that COVID has done is it has, as I mentioned, it has stretched election officials thin, and it's been an incredible challenge. And you know, they remain the most important heroes of this election story. What it's done is it has accelerated a number of changes, right? So vote by mail, for example, has been dramatically accelerated. And I think when you have such a large challenge to everything we do, like COVID, it does open up opportunities to rethink certain things. Mm-hmm. And even for in-person voting, this thing's happening now. I don't know if you've seen it, where large sports arenas are being used as vote centers because guess what? They're accessible to people in wheelchairs by design, right? They have to be. They're very large, so they're safer in terms of air circulation, right? They have very high requirements on air circulation. You can concentrate a lot of voters. They have large parking lots, right? So this movement that's happening around voting in large sports arenas, it might be hard to continue once, you know, sports are back, but it's a fascinating development. It's incredibly resourceful and creative of election officials to go there. So necessity is, what's the saying? The mother of invention?
Mother of invention.
Yeah, necessity is the mother of invention.
We could have like voting parks in the future, you know?
We could have voting parks. Yeah. It leads me to like thinking about how do we take a step back, right? How do we think about the bigger picture? Mm-hmm. The word in my mind that we have to think about when we think about voting systems is resiliency. So much is at stake when somebody's trying to vote. If you fail them, if you disenfranchise them, you failed. You failed the democratic process. And so you want voting systems and processes and everything around voter election administration to be resilient to lots of little failures. Because if you fall apart the moment you have a small failure, then somebody doesn't get to vote, right? It might be, and maybe hundreds of people don't get to vote. And what I like, the reason I'm connecting it to this, these large arenas and whatnot, is that when you have a large voting center with a lot of machines, a number of tabulators, a lot of people, you also have a lot of redundancy, right? Like the power's not going to go out at State Farm Arena in Atlanta, right? Like they know how to keep the power going at the arena. They've done it before, right? If a machine breaks, there's like 300 others. If there's a technical problem, there are people there on location to help you. So in the process of dealing with COVID, There's some aspects where we've become less resilient because COVID is just making things so difficult, and some other aspects where we've become more resilient. And I think resiliency is the key aspect of any voting system. Mm. Not enough attention is paid to that in general.
Yeah, I think you're right. But at the same time that we have, you know, arenas opening up for voting, we have places like Texas where there is one drop-off ballot per county. You know, so some counties have 4 million people, some have 400, and they both are offering the same access. So voter suppression, which is something I think we'll get into a little bit later, is another aspect of this that that's just quite scary. But one thing that we've heard a lot about in the last few months is online voting.
Yep.
Which is quite broad and I know has issues with the secret ballot. But maybe you can just give us some of the risks of online voting and help us understand the process that, as it stands, it typically entails.
So I want to be very clear. There are two parts that folks think about sometimes when they think about online voting. They think about electronic ballot delivery, which is, can you get your ballot online, receive your empty ballot online? And then electronic ballot return, which is, can you return your filled-in ballot electronically? The first part, electronic ballot delivery, is actually really critical for a number of voters, voters with disabilities or, you know, voters that might be in the hospital for any number of reasons. It's really important. It's actually a product that we offer at VotingWorks, Accessible Vote by Mail, AVBM, that we offer to a number of states where they can deliver ballots to voters in their web browser. They can either print them out, fill them out on paper and mail them, or if they need assistive technologies, they can fill them out in their web browser and then print it, filled, and mail it, right? So filling it out in their web browser lets the voter use their text-to-speech and any other tools they have if they have any visual impairments. And we think that's a really important thing for access. Electronic ballot return, where you return your filled-out ballot over the internet, that doesn't happen very much. There's a handful of small pilots that have been run by some companies in some localities. I'm not in favor of them. I don't think they're a good idea.
Why is that?
Because of what I mentioned before, right? The fact that I don't know how to secure it. Maybe another way that I can give you the intuition for why it's a problem is picture yourself on your iPhone, because the iPhone would probably be the most secure way to do this, right? So you're on your iPhone, you load your voting app, you fill out your ballot for Donald Trump or Joe Biden, right? And then you click submit. And the cell phone says, congratulations, you voted. And I want you to picture yourself in that moment where the cell phone tells you, congratulations, you voted. And understand that that's the last you're ever going to hear about your ballot. You're not going to be able to come back and check later and see if it was recorded properly. Because again, if the system lets you do that, you could sell your vote. And we don't want you to be able to sell your vote, right? So you're looking at that screen, it says, thank you for voting. And that's it, you're done. Why do you trust that your ballot was recorded properly? Like, what is it that gives you confidence that it was recorded for Trump if you voted for Trump, that it was recorded for Biden if you voted for Biden? In any other app on your phone, whatever action you take is going to have some side effect so that if it wasn't done properly, you're going to know, right? If you post something to Facebook and it mangles your message, and you know, you're going to know because your friends are going to be like, what did you just post? Like, what is this, right? If you transfer money in your bank account and it's not the right amount, you're going to find out, right? If you pay a bill online, you're going to find out because there will be consequences to that action being done improperly. When you vote, once you get that thank you screen, how do you know? You just don't know. Mm. And that's the core reason why it's not something we know how to solve right now.
And there's no solution in the blockchain or some sort of temporary passcode that locks you into to a public ledger that you could see where your bar is or anything.
Right. So you have to think about like any tool that exists that would let you go and check how you voted. Mm-hmm. If it just shows you, congratulations, you voted for Joe Biden, right? Like, and you can come back a day later or 2 days later and say that, like, you don't have a secret ballot. Mm-hmm. If you can do that, you've lost the secret ballot.
Right.
And if you can't do that, then how do you know?
Right.
The blockchain and these kinds of technologies, they can help solve some aspects of implementing a secure voting system, but they do not solve this crucial aspect of making sure your ballot was recorded the way you intended it without revealing it to somebody else. Now, there are potentially some cryptographic techniques that exist that let you solve this dilemma. of verifying that your ballot was cast properly. I spent my PhD working on those techniques, and I've spent a bunch of time with other cryptographers working on those techniques.
Right.
My conclusion in 2020 is that it's not sufficiently usable by people without a crypto background, right? It requires too much knowledge to do. And if it requires that much knowledge, then most people wouldn't be able to actually verify their ballot. And if they can't verify their ballot, then, you know, what's the point? If only the cryptographers can do it, that's not quite good enough. So maybe one day we'll figure it out. Mm. But fundamentally, there's this issue of, it doesn't matter what technology we bring to the table. Once you see that thank you voted screen on your phone, just ask yourself, like, do you feel like it was recorded properly? What would you have to know? What would you have to hear to know that it was recorded properly? Understanding that you cannot delegate to anybody else, you cannot tell another cryptographer or somebody else, like, I voted for Biden, can you check that it was recorded for Biden? Or I voted for Trump, can you? No, because if you do that, if that's possible, you can sell your vote. And we don't want you to sell your vote. The whole reason for the secret ballot implemented in the US in 1892 was specifically to prevent people from selling their votes, because vote selling was rampant before 1892.
Mm.
Yeah.
So in terms of the most pressing issues right now,
yes,
regarding voter suppression, what in your mind are they?
So the one thing I want to say is, as you're thinking about the issue of voter suppression, there's politicians and then there's, you know, election officials that are doing the work of actually running elections, right? The first thing to understand is that politicians are going to be politicians, and they will do things that are not always good for voter enfranchisement. We are a nonpartisan organization. I try not to wade into partisan topics, right? I do get frustrated, though, when politicians take measures that make voting harder for no good reason. And I think it's pretty clear there are some actions that have been taken in the last...
Has that been happening recently?
It's happened. Of course it's happened. I think it's also important to look on the ground at, like, all the measures that have happened to help people vote, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's early voting or vote by mail, there's a lot. And when you look at the turnout right now, it's just unbelievable. I mean, I've spent a long time talking with election experts across the board, and I don't think anybody saw this turnout coming. Mm-hmm. Something like Texas is at 65% of their 2016 turnout, and there's 12 more days of voting to go. That's completely bonkers, right? So yes, there's voter suppression efforts that are couched in voting security arguments. And that's always frustrating, especially coming from a security background where you hate it when security is used as an excuse.
Well, voter fraud is so rare, and yet we have a president and certain Republicans who are so stuck on it. Why do you think that they are trying to weave this narrative, or what about this narrative seems to be so?
All I can tell you is that the science says that it's not happening. It's one of those things that you can act. There are some things you can't measure in elections. It's really hard to measure. And then there are some things that you can, right? People double voting, or like people voting on behalf of others, like that leaves a trace. There's a signature somewhere. There's a person checking in person. The reason folks get caught is because it's really hard to carry out one of those attacks without getting caught. It happens. You know, the studies put it at like 0.00004%. It's not impossible, but it's never the thing that's even come close to swinging an election.
Yeah, it would never tip it.
Never, right? Like it just wouldn't. And it's important to understand that, one, it's not just technological defenses here that are in place to prevent it. There are significant counter incentives to this. If you cast a vote on behalf of somebody else, just one vote, you are going to jail. Chances are you will get caught and you will go to jail for a long time. This is not something that the election officials and law enforcement fail to take seriously. They take it generally very seriously. You know, I can't speak to people's motivations on these things. I can just speak to the science. And the science says that voter fraud is not a significant issue. Of course, we should continue to implement, you know, processes in voting that continue to make voter fraud hard, right? That continue to make voter fraud detectable. So it's not like we should never consider it. Of course we should. But we also shouldn't treat it like a fire, because it's not a fire.
Yeah.
It's not a significant issue right now.
On the digital warfare front, how concerned are you about Russia meddling in our election this year? And should we also be worried about China?
So I'm not an expert in the exact sources of disinformation and kind of psychological warfare that's happening. You know, the folks I know who are in this space clearly say that that's happening, just like it did in 2016, right? Significant efforts. And that a lot of the efforts this year are likely around reducing trust in the election itself, right? Mm. Reducing trust in the democratic process. And I have hope that as a species, as the human species, we are getting better at understanding disinformation online. Although I think it's going to take some time. I think it's going to take generational mm-hmm. changes to get to a place where we are more immune to disinformation, that we know how to tell the wheat from the chaff in the online information space. I think we're all vulnerable to it to some degree. Again, my gut says we're a little less vulnerable to it this year than maybe 4 years ago, but also the attacks are probably going to be a little bit more intricate in terms of disinformation. What it comes down to for me, the best way to counter this is to take a deep breath. Mm. Don't over-rotate on every story you hear. Don't retweet or reshare everything. Go read the article. Don't just retweet the headline, right? Just be a little slower with your information consumption and spreading, and then just go vote. Because ultimately, if we have turnout that is far beyond what we had in 2016, that's what makes the election more legitimate. You know, the higher the turnout, the more legitimate the election. Ignore the crud, the fear. We saw it in the attack that Iran's been blamed for now. Mm-hmm. This is just a fear tactic, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's nobody's changing vote totals or anything like that. They're just scaring people. And it's a problem. And the best response is don't amplify that stuff. Go vote. Tell your friends and family to vote. That's the most important thing you can do.
Mm. You mentioned the wheat and the chaff. So, you know, before we finish, I did want to bring up baking. I read that that's one of your hobbies.
Yes, it is. So it is.
I was wondering, what have you been baking during the pandemic?
The last month, I have not been baking much, but I did buy a 50-pound bag of flour at the beginning of the pandemic because I was like, I need some flour. And it was the only quantity available on Amazon. And I think I have officially gone through that 50-pound bag of flour. Now, unlike other folks I know who are just too good at this, I just don't want to compete. I don't do bread. I do pastries and brioche. And in my almost two-year quest now to bake brioche, I actually baked a brioche I was really proud of about a month ago before I went heads down for the last straightaway here before the election. I was pretty excited about that. And, all my recipes come from Flour Bakery in Boston. I spent a long time in Boston. If you're ever in Boston, flour is the best.
Mm. Do you see a crossover or a parallel between baking and voting?
I haven't thought of that. Maybe the parallel is like all the ways in which things can go wrong, right? And how it takes a lot of, like for a long time, I had trouble getting the brioche right. Because, and this is going to be stupid to experienced bakers, I didn't realize I had to activate my yeast. Nothing in the recipe said I had to activate the yeast. And if you know what that is, you're probably laughing. And if you don't know what that is, a lot of yeast comes, you know, it's been effectively cryogenically preserved, right? And you have to like wake it up so that it can, you know, eat the sugars and make bubbles and make your brioche rise. And if you don't activate it, guess what? Like, and activating it is just putting it in 110 degree Fahrenheit water and letting it wake up, basically. And if you don't do that, your brioche just doesn't rise, and it's super frustrating. And then the moment you do it, it works, right? It's one of like the many little things that if you don't know can fail. And I think election administration has that. A lot of folks in the election space, they compare election day to a wedding day where you spent all this time preparing and then the day of, everything needs to go in like perfect synchronicity and all that stuff, except you're running like 100 weddings all over the county at the same time, right? Like on the same day. And just like a wedding, if you build in a lot of like redundancy and resilience, then you will have a lot of little failures and nobody will notice, right? Mm-hmm. Because everything will go okay. And so lots of little things can go wrong in elections. And the takeaway to connect back to what I was saying earlier, for me is I want Voting Works. And I think we are doing this at Voting Works is we're trying to build a voting system that is more resilient to everyday failures. And that's going to mean that not that we don't fail, but that we can tolerate those failures and keep going and never let the voting stop.
Before we let you go, as a final question,
sure.
You know, as we emerge from not just this election, but hopefully this global pandemic, what is your greatest hope?
If it's more broadly than elections, but connected to elections, my greatest hope is that we come out of this experience rediscovering the things that connect us rather than the things that divide us. We're an extremely polarized country right now, politically. We're polarized around things like masks, which is nuts. And we have to reconnect to this idea that it doesn't take much to realize that we're all human and we all face the same challenges. You know, in this case, really the same challenge, COVID. I just hope, you know, humanity has a number of very large problems to tackle together in the next few years. I hope COVID is a wake-up call for us to do that all together.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Ben. This was fascinating.
Thanks, you too, and appreciate the opportunity to go a little deeper on this topic.
Thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To sign up for our weekly newsletter, Exploring the Five Senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv.